Amateur Radio Newsline Report 1922, with a release date of June 13, 2014, to follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. The FCC announces some changes to amateur radio licensing and more. Hams take issue with indoor marijuana farmers over interference from grow lights. A pair of X-class flares erupt on the sun. Marines learn how to T-hunt from a North Carolina radio club. Dayton announces 2014 Hamvention attendance and part two of our look at amateur radio on the International Space Station. All this and more on Amateur Radio Newsline, report number 1922, coming your way right now.
From around the world, this is Newsline, Amateur Radio's independent on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now, here is this week's report.
The FCC says that the public interest will be served by revising the amateur service rules to grant partial examination credit for certain expired amateur operator licenses, to permit examinations to be administered remotely, and to permit amateur stations to use technologies that stations in other service are already permitted to use. This is the gist of a report and order issued by the regulatory agency on June 9th that acts on several long-standing rules changes requests. Amateur Radio Newsline's Bruce Tennant, K6PZW, is here with the details.
In its decision, the FCC will make it a bit easier for hams whose license have expired to get back into the service. This by granting written examination credit for test elements 3 and 4 to holders of expired licenses that initially required passage of these elements. However, the regulatory agency will require former license holders whose lapsed licenses have gone past the 2-year renewal grace period to pass the Element 2 technician class exam to get their licenses restored. In the same action, the Commission refused to give examination credit to the holder of an expired certificate of successful completion of examination, nor will it extend the validity of them for the lifetime of the holder of these documents. The FCC has decided to continue the requirement that 3 volunteer examiners be present at amateur testing sessions. The agency had earlier proposed to drop that number down to 2 after noting that some applicants could not find a test session because it was not possible to find 3 volunteer examiners in some rural geographical areas. There was strong opposition to this proposal by the majority of those filing comments, as well as the American Radio Relay League. In deciding against making this change, the FCC said that it was persuaded to keep the current 3 volunteer examiner rule to assure that the security and quality of the exams would not be compromised. While the number of volunteer examinees will remain at 3, the FCC did offer some relief for those who cannot find a local exam session by approving the concept of allowing remote testing. It notes that as far back as 2002, the National Conference of Volunteer Examiner Coordinators endorsed experimental use of video conferencing technology to conduct amateur radio testing in remote areas of Alaska. The Anchorage Volunteer Examination Coordinator Group has long requested such a change. It cited the expense to provide amateur radio test sessions to Alaska residents living in remote areas of that state. The FCC declined to address the mechanics of remote testing, as this will likely vary from location to location and session to session. It stated that specific rules spelling out how to administer exam sessions remotely could limit the flexibility of conducting these sessions. Instead, it reasserted that the obligation on the part of volunteer examiners and VECs to administer examinations responsibly applies in full to remote testing as well as any other test session. Last but by no means least, the FCC has adopted an ARRL proposal to authorize certain types of time division multiple access, better known as TDMA emissions, for permanent use by radio amateurs. Back in 2013, the Wireless Telecommunications Bureau had granted the League request for a temporary blanket waiver to permit radio amateurs to transmit emissions with designators FXD, FXE, and F7E, pending resolution of the rulemaking petition. In issuing its final decision on this matter, the FCC stated that those commenting strongly supported such a change. Also noted was that such a modification to its rules is consistent with the basis and purpose of the Part 97 amateur service. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Bruce Tennant, K6PZW in Los Angeles.
All of these rules changes become effective 30 days after their publication in the Federal Register. We should have that date for you next week. One ham very much concerned with ham radio testing procedures is famed educator Gordon West, WB6NOA. We asked West what he thought of several of the changes, starting with the reinstatement for those whose licenses had lapsed and who had not renewed them within the 2-year grace period. He gave us his personal experience with those wanting back in.
We get maybe once every 2 weeks a call from a ham whose call license expired by more than 2 years. And after I talk with them, telling them they need to take 3 exams to get back to extra class, I never hear from them again. But now I'll be able to say 1 examination, Element 2 technician class, and then you will be reinstated to either your general, advanced, or extra class license you once held.
And what about the requirement that those seeking license reinstatement outside the grace period be subject to taking a new technician class exam? West says that he agrees with the FCC on this.
I think it's good that a reinstated ham would have to pass some sort of an examination. And Element 2 is a good starting point because Element 2 has a lot more rules and regulations that encompass the overall ham radio service. So I think they did it just right by asking the applicant to consider taking the Element 2 exam if they want to get back their original general, advanced, or extra class ticket.
We also asked WB6NOA for his thoughts on the FCC's decision to permit remote testing for candidates unable to attend a normal exam session in person.
I think our VE program, administered by VECs, is pretty darn tight. And I think that, especially up in Alaska, where Jim Wiley had a lot to do with some of these suggestions to the commission, I think there are areas that we could monitor via teleconference to ensure exam integrity and get more hams passing the test and upgrading that we might not have had before because we couldn't get a 3-member team to them.
Finally, we asked him to give us his overall thoughts on the way the FCC handled these changes to ham radio exam and license reinstatement procedures.
I'm delighted to see that the FCC has taken the amount of time to consider all of the comments that fellow hams and I have submitted to them on these 3 topics. It tells me the FCC continuously listens to input, and they cite those inputs as based on what their decision is, and I think it's good that we have a commission that listens as well as enacts new rules.
The assessment of the regulatory changes to ham radio licensing and testing from amateur radio educator Gordon West, WB6NOA. In other news, the IARU monitoring system newsletter reports success in getting an Australian radar system removed from the 20-meter ham band. According to a report from Wolf Hadel, DK2OM, back on May 10th, John Martin, ZL1GWE, and another source informed him about a Superdam radar to be found on 14.050 MHz. It turned out that this radar system was being operated by the La Trobe University in Australia. At this point, DK2OM got back to ZL1GWE, who informed the university that it was operating in a ham radio band. Hadel also sent the information to Peter Young, VK3MV, who serves as the IARU Monitoring System Region 3 Coordinator. He, in turn, informed the Australian Department of Post and Telecommunications of the situation. The bottom line? Thanks to the combined efforts of these 3 hams, the offending radar signal was gone from 20 meters within 2 days. In DX Upfront, word that a team of operators from Japan will likely be on the air with their individual home call signs, stroke CE0Y, from Hare Kapone on Easter Island between January 9th and 17th of 2015. Activity will be holiday style on 80 through 6 meters using CW, SSB, and the digital modes, QSL via the operator's instructions. Time for you to identify your station. We are the Amateur Radio Newsline, heard on bulletin stations around the world, including the NS4R repeater serving Jacksonville, Florida. Various news sources report that the sun unleashed a pair of X-class solar flares in the span of 1 hour and 10 minutes on Tuesday morning, June 10th. These flares came from a sunspot on the lower left limb of our home star that had just rotated into view and was named Active Region 2087 by solar scientists. The first flare, the more powerful of the two, erupted at 7:42 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time and was declared a Class X 2.2. The second came at 8:52 a.m. Eastern and was designated an X 1.5. X-rays and ultraviolet radiation from the double flare created a wave of ionization in Earth's upper atmosphere, altering the normal propagation of radio transmissions over Europe. Preliminary images from NASA's STEREO probes show a bright coronal mass ejection emerging from the blast area, but it was away from the Sun-Earth line. As such, no strong impacts were expected. The area calmed down after its two violent outbursts, but the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Space Weather Prediction Center says the new active region remains a potent force. As such, there could be more flares that could cause radio blackouts if they were to take place here on Earth. Marijuana growing operations using what are called indoor grow lights are making life miserable for hams and SWLs. That's because many of these units emit wideband interference all across the high-frequency radio spectrum. Some can even wreak havoc on the bands from 6 meters and above. Amateur Radio Newsline's Mark Abramovich, NT3V, has more on the problem of pot growers versus two-way radio.
A recent story picked up by USA Today and the Associated Press from the pages of the Colorado newspaper reports on this new source of interference for amateur radio operators. The story tracks the problems faced by Thomas Thompson, W0IVJ, of Boulder, Colorado, who discovered RF interference, which he traced to the ballast of the grow lights being used by some of his neighbors. Thompson reported his findings to the ARL and also posted a page about the problem on the web. You can find the link by going to the web version of this story at arnewsline.org. He notes the interference problem is significant on 40 meters. Thompson, a retired electrical engineer, was able to find the source of the interference with direction-finding equipment, according to the news stories. He then decided that the best way to address the problems was to build filters for his neighbors to take care of the interference. The ARRL, according to the Coloradan, filed a complaint with the FCC about the grow lamps. The Coloradan says the FCC told its reporter that the agency is aware of the interference, but didn't say what it was going to do about it. The ARRL has produced information about the problem at a link on its website. You can also find that at our web version of the story. It recommends filters and chokes to alleviate the problem if you know the neighbor where you've identified the source. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Mark Abramovich, NT3V.
One word of caution to any ham thinking of confronting a suspected marijuana grower, especially if it's someone you don't know. In three words, don't do it. While there may be some people out there who are growing these plants for medical use, you could easily run into a large-scale cultivating operation being run by members of the underworld who are armed and dangerous. Instead, if you T-hunt down such a location, just file a report of the interference and where you believe it's coming from with your closest FCC office and let the professionals handle it from there. United States Marines know that being able to locate a lost person or find an enemy might save lives, and their training prepares them for this. But there are some things classroom training can't teach, which is why Sergeant Philip Rice, KK4NBK, and a dozen other Marines recently traveled from Camp Lejeune to Salisbury, North Carolina, to learn the art of hidden transmitter hunting from members of the Rowan Amateur Radio Society. In an interview with the Salisbury Post newspaper, Sergeant Rice says he tries to locate opportunities for hands-on training that will help members of his unit be more prepared for their duties. As a part of the day's training, club members Tommy Wood, N4YZ, and Gary Lang, K4GHL, showed some of the specialized antennas used for radio direction finding. Afterward, the Marines paired up with members of the club as they fanned out through the woods on the outskirts of Salisbury for a T-hunt practice session. According to Sergeant Rice, amateur radio is a good way to open people's minds and prepare them for more than just our current war on terror. You can read the entire story of this group effort between the Marines and the Rowan Amateur Radio Society at tinyurl.com/Marines and Hams. An interesting article on the demise of the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, or HARP facility, in Alaska, appeared in the June 4th edition of the Anchorage Press newspaper. The article by Mary Lochner not only tells some of the history of the multi-megawatt transmitting station, but also explains in easy-to-understand terminology just how the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program actually functioned. It also goes into some of the unsuccessful efforts undertaken by supporters of the research facility to keep it from being shuttered and torn down. Titled HARP Plays One Last Song, you can read the very fascinating story online at tinyurl.com/HAARP-swansong. Radio supplier Bofeng has changed its product distribution name to Pofeng for all sales outside China. In an announcement on its website, the company says that it feels it's time to adapt its brand to the global stage. It notes that the current name Bofeng is a literal translation of its Chinese character name, and as such it may be difficult for a hobbyist elsewhere in the world to pronounce. The company says that its new product name of Pofeng is easier to pronounce and more friendly to its customers while maintaining the phonetic symbolism of its brand. The company's official web domain, bofengradio.com, will remain unchanged. It seems that each year after the close of Hamvention that there's a big guessing game as to attendance. Long ago, it was just between hams talking on the telephone, but since the advent of the World Wide Web, it's kind of become an online sport or some such. Well, the final results are now in, and the number was announced at a recent meeting of the Dayton Amateur Radio Association by this year's Assistant General Chairman, Jim Tiderman, N8IDS.
Those that came close to 25,000 were very close. Very simply, it was 24,873.
So, how does this compare with years past? Well, in 2013, some 24,542 hams made the trek to Hamvention for a net increase of 331 attendees this year. It's also way up from 2008, when only 17,250 showed up at the Hara Arena gates. The bottom line is that as the world's economy improves, so does the number of visitors to the Dayton Hamvention, and that's good news for everyone concerned. Tim Duffy, K3LR, says that select video presentations from the 2014 Contest University held at the recent Dayton Hamvention are now available for viewing at the Contest University website. The shortcut URL is simply tinyurl.com/ctu-video-2014. Also, for the first time in 8 years, there will be a second contest university in the United States offered in the same year. This one will take place on Thursday, July 17th, which is the opening day of the ARRL Centennial Convention in Hartford, Connecticut. More information on this is on the web at ARRL2014.org under All Day Training Tracks. Also now available on YouTube is a video produced by Joe Eisenberg, K0NEB, taken at this year's Hamvention. Titled Sharp-Dressed Man, it's actually a slideshow set to music as seen through the lens of Joe's Canon digital camera. It's a very enjoyable 4.5 minutes of Hamvention fun that you can find by taking your web browser to tinyurl.com/K0NEB-Dayton-2014. This is Ham Radio News for today's radio amateur. We are the Amateur Radio Newsline with links to the world from our only official website at www.arnewsline.org and being relayed by the volunteer services of the following radio amateur. A big celebration of early ham radio on Earth to Moon to Earth contacts will soon take place in the United Kingdom as we hear from Jeremy Boot, G4NJH.
July 2004 marks the 50th anniversary of the first time that amateur signals from the UK reached other parts of the world by bouncing off the moon, a technique known as Moon Bounce or Earth Moon Earth, EME. In the July 1964 edition of Radio Communications, the RSGB announced that at 2020 GMT on June the 13th, 1964, G3 LTF at Galleywood, Essex, and KP4BPZ in Puerto Rico made contact on 430 megacycles per second, yes, by bouncing their signals off the moon. Signal reports were RST459 both ways. A further contact took place an hour later. Now, KP4BPZ was fortunate in having a 1,000-foot radio telescope dish antenna at Arecibo in Puerto Rico at his disposal. G3LTF's equipment included a 15-foot dish aerial and an AF139 transistor preamplifier for reception. Power input to the PA was 150 watts, and what's more remarkable is that Peter G3LTF is still active on moon bounds and is one of the world's leading pioneers. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Jeremy Boot, G4NJH in Nottingham in the UK.
And lest we forget, our heartiest congratulations to Jeremy and to the GB2RS podcast team on having received 100,000 hits on their weekly newscasts on Podbean. Each week, the GB2RS audio newscast is uploaded to both iTunes and Podbean.com. The Brazilian Amateur Radio League has obtained special permission from telecommunications regulator Anatel. This to permit foreign amateurs visiting that nation to operate during the duration of the FIFA World Cup. During June and July, any foreign amateur will be able to operate in Brazil regardless of the existence of reciprocity agreement between countries. No special license is necessary and no fees are required. Hams who wish to take advantage of this opportunity need only send the Brazilian Amateur Radio League copies of certain documents. These include a copy of the identification pages of their valid passport, a copy of a valid amateur radio license of his or her country, a list of cities from where he or she intends to operate, and an email address for contact. The documents should be scanned and sent via email to executive@labre.org.br. The FIFA World Cup, often simply the World Cup, is an international football competition played by the senior men's national teams, all of whom are members of the Federación Internacional de Football Association. In DX, ZL1 GWE will be active as 5W0JM from Savai'i, Samoa until June 23rd. He's reported to be operating on 40 through 10 meters using CW and SSB, QSL via his home call sign. DL2JRM will be operational portable stroke CT9 from Madeira Island through June 19th. Activity is on 80 through 10 meters CW, QSL via his home call sign, direct or by the Bureau. K2QBV will be active as E51QBV from Rarotonga Island from July 8th to the 21st. According to K2QBV, this is not a de-expedition, but rather the second phase of his summer vacation that will start in New Zealand. QSL via his home station address. VK3ATX will be operational stroke P from Gabo Island on August 16th and 17th. Activity will be on the high frequency bands. QSL via his home call sign, direct only. VK3VTH will be active stroke 7 from King Island between August 14th and 17th. His operation will be on 40 and 20 meters using SSB only. QSL via VK3VTH, either direct or via the Bureau. OH4SS will be operational stroke OH0 from Brando Island between June 28th and the 30th. Activity will probably be only on 40, 17, and 15 meters on SSB only. QSL direct only via OH4SS. Lastly, AF1G is reported operational from Andros Islands on the weekends, U.S. holidays, and some contests. His activity is on 80 through 6 meters using SSB and the digital modes. QSL logbook of the world or direct with a self-addressed stamped envelope, direct only. No Bureau QSLs for this one. And finally this week, we present part two of a look back at amateur radio on the International Space Station, or ERIS program. Or in this case, maybe more of a look at it today. Here's Skeeter Nash, N5ASH.
According to part three of KN4AQ's mini-documentary, ERIS to the Max, NASA would like to see participation in an ERIS contact to go beyond a few students involved in an exchange with crew members on board the International Space Station. and on the occasion of the contact with the Dixon Elementary School in North Carolina, two public information officers pitched in to assist. Susie Ulbrich is the PIO for Onslow County Schools, and Janice Hopkins, KJ4JPE, a new ARRL PIO covering coastal North Carolina. Ulbrich explained that they had overlapped in making their media contacts, and it helped.
When we talked after, we found out that we had reached out to some of the same people. But like I said, I think them getting two notices worked because they really knew how important it was hearing it from them and hearing it from us. And yep. We got responses immediately that we'll be there, we'll be there, we'll be there.
Hopkins began doing public information informally for her local club, saw how valuable it was, and expanded her coverage.
I've been doing that for the last 3 years, sending my information out to the different newspapers and magazines. Then I decided I was going to branch out, and the area clubs in the area, New Bern and Onslow, Pamlico, and whatever they did, I would try to get into the media. I'm now an official PIO for amateur radio through ARRL.
Heiress to the Max then wraps up with a special treat, especially for those who have never seen nor heard a space shuttle launch. Part 4 is a look back at one of the early SARx contacts. SARx, which stands for the Shuttle Amateur Radio Experiment, is the predecessor to the Heiress program. It officially began in late 1985 with the flight of Tony England, W0ORE, on board the Shuttle Challenger for mission STS-51F. This sound you are about to hear is the actual launch countdown from a SARx mission number STS-50 in 1992 and was the sixth in the series of early manned ham radio flights into space.
We have main engine start. 2, 1, solid rocket ignition, and liftoff. Liftoff of Endeavour on America's 50th space shuttle flight.
The sound of ham radio history, as it was about to be made more than a decade ago. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Skeeter Nash, N5ASH.
Heiress to the Max can be seen at the website hamradionow.tv. Look for episode 144. With thanks to Allen Labs, AMSAT, the ARRL, CQ Magazine, the FCC, the Ohio Penn DX Bulletin, Radio Netherlands, RAIN, the RSGB, the South African Radio League, the Southgate News, Twit TV, Australia's WIA News, and you, our listeners, that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline. Our email address is newsline@arnewsline.org. More information is available at Amateur Radio Newsline's only official website, located at www.arnewsline.org. You can also write to us or support us at Amateur Radio Newsline, 28197 Robin Avenue, Santa Clarita, California, 91350. For now, with Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF at the editor's desk, I'm Ralph Squillaci, KK6ITB near Los Angeles, saying 73, and we thank you for listening. Amateur Radio Newsline is copyright 2014, all rights reserved.